format tonight is I'm going to be doing a guided meditation for a little bit, then we'll segue into silent sitting. And then I'd like to share a teaching with you that's been very helpful for me, both in my practice and my recovery from alcoholism. And then we'll have a discussion. So I hope you're on board for that and that we can have a wonderful sangha together this evening. And I know some of you are coming from very far away, so I really appreciate you all being here tonight. So if you're physically able to sit up straight, it's wonderful to have some strength in your lower back. I also like to do a spinal twist before I sit. We carry so much tension in our shoulders and in our back. So let's begin by strengthening our back, feeling the spine lifting up through the crown of the head. And let's take a few deep breaths. And these deep breaths are an invitation for us to fully enter the present moment with one another. Bring your attention to the crown of your head. And I'd like you to just allow yourself to travel gently through your body, noticing any places where you are tense or holding on, and gently invite that tension to let go, relaxing through the neck and shoulders, releasing the upper arms, the lower arms, and the fingers. You might notice as you bring attention into your hands that they tend to warm a little bit. Releasing through the back of the body and the front of the body. Bringing attention to the place where your body is resting on a chair or cushion. And letting your attention flow down through the legs. The upper legs, the knees, and the calves, and letting your energy reach all the way to the tips of your toes. As you breathe, imagine that your breath is reaching to the farthest corners of your body and even releasing out beyond the margins of your body into the world with which you are interconnected. There is great trouble and suffering in the world right now and always. And as we let go of some of the images and news that may have been troubling us, let's bring our attention into the heart area. And imagine as you're breathing, that you're breathing out a golden tendril of compassion and loving kindness, that you're releasing this compassion and loving kindness out into a troubled world. Breathing in and out through the heart area. I'm going to share some phrases with you now. And I'd like you just to hold each phrase in your mind for a moment and let it penetrate your being, and then gently let it go. I choose to enjoy this moment. I feel the air flowing in and out of my body. I also feel the movement in my chest and belly as I breathe. I'm aware of my whole body at once, alive and awake in this present moment. I am ready to experience the feelings in my heart. I let go of all stress and worry and feel peaceful inside. I accept everyone I know just as they are. I honor and love myself just as I am. I am open to receive. I feel connected with my higher power. I am here to serve, to love, to prosper, and to enjoy myself. I am ready to act with courage and integrity. Our higher power is as close as our breath. Conscious awareness of its presence strengthens us moment by moment. The past is gone. The present is full of possibilities. May I be aware of the strength at hand. Welcome back. Let's stretch a little bit. Be kind to our bodies. You know, I'd love to be able to see more of your faces if you're able to share your face with us. Again, my name is Laura Burgess. I practice at the San Francisco Zen Center. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about my personal adventures before and after. At Zen Center, when we have a practice period, each person shares their way-seeking mind with the group. And this is very much like our stories in recovery of how we came to practice. And for me, my struggle with alcoholism and my practice are inextricably woven together. I'm sorry, I'm dealing with a little bit of an allergy cough. I grew up in the East Bay in Pleasant Hill, California, and started drinking when I was a teenager. And very early in my drinking, I started to manifest some of the symptoms of alcoholism. You know, when I drank, I wanted more. I was painfully shy. And I found that when I did drink, my personality changed. I could dance all night and actually talk to people and be a wild woman, you know, and the next day I could blame it all on the alcohol. Very early in my drinking, I started experiencing blackouts, which was actually very frightening for me. But, you know, I had some wonderful adventures with alcohol. My boyfriend at the time and I, when we were very young, traveled overland from Europe to India and back. And to be traveling through countries that are permeated with spirituality was a real eye-opener for me. But I did use every drug that came my way on that trip, you know. And I hit my first alcoholic bottom after that relationship ended, and I went to Juneau, Alaska. And I had this idea that I was going to leave that relationship and be an independent woman and see the wilderness. But instead, I spent all my time at the Red Dog Saloon and the Dreamland. And that's when I really entered what I would call the heart of darkness of alcoholism, where I didn't know what was going to happen when I drank. You know, I could have one drink and get plastered or drink all night and not get drunk at all. And one thing that really got my attention was I came to out of a blackout crawling through the snow. And I know that people die that way in those northern climates. And I decided that Juneau, Alaska was my problem and came back to San Francisco. And that's when I really experienced pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization because I didn't want to drink that way anymore. And I just couldn't help myself. And I had a really profound run with alcohol where I smoked a lot of cigarettes and drank a lot of cheap wine and I just could not pick up a drink. And during that beautiful window, I stumbled into San Francisco Zen Center and I quit drinking. I just quit drinking. I shut the door and wished to forget the past and shut the door on it. And I started sitting Zazen. In the Soto Zen tradition, we sit on black zafus facing the wall. And every time I sat down, I cried for quite a while when I was practicing. And, you know, a friend of mine who's not an alcoholic, hi, Jim. Wow. A friend of mine who's not an alcoholic told me, alcohol is like a credit card for pain. You pay it back later with interest. And that's what I was doing. And I was detoxing. And I'm very fortunate that within a very short time, I was living at Tassara Zen Mountain Center. And I love the rigor of practice. I loved monastic practice. You know, in a monastic training period, we get up at 4:30 in the morning, we go to the Zendo and sit 2 periods of Zazen. We have study hall. I got to study Buddhism. And we do physical work. You know, there's an expression in Zen, chop wood, carry water. And I really loved the clarity and the intention and the rigor of that practice. And I did not say, my name is Laura and I'm an alcoholic. I just didn't drink. And so after 5 years of practice, by this time I had gotten married and my husband and I had a beautiful daughter. That marriage came to an end, and alcohol started creeping back into my life. And I did not understand how I could sit still for 7 days during a Zen sesshin, and yet I could not conquer alcohol. I did not understand that. And so I was always trying to stop drinking, and I'd stop for various periods of time, maybe for a week, maybe for a month, maybe for a few months. But my Zen practice did not keep me from picking up a drink again. And after 5 years of this really secret drinking, I didn't want my daughter to grow up with alcoholism the way I had. And I didn't want my Zen center community to know that I drank the way I did. And so I think a lot of women tend to drink secretly because it's not as socially acceptable for us to be stumbling around like that. Well, I decided what I wanted to do was teach kids, and I went back to school to get a teaching credential. And after a very bad night of drinking, I was sitting in a classroom at San Francisco State, and I had this moment of clarity that I'd had all these wonderful blessings in my life, a beautiful daughter, world travel. I had had wonderful Buddhist teachers and Buddhist training, and Buddhism did not cure my alcoholism. And I also brought to mind the many wonderful Buddhist teachers we've known who have harmed or destroyed their communities because they were in the thrall of addiction. And for those wonderful teachers, Buddhism also did not cure their alcoholism. And so I got up out of that, and in that classroom, something inside of me called out, please, please help me. And I got up and I went and made a phone call and stepped into the rooms of recovery. And that was on September 28th, 1985. Once I had been had my te received my teacher training at Zen Center at Green Gulch Farm, and the first thing I wanted to do was to offer retreats for people in recovery. And so that was in 2000, and during these years I've been and I met Kevin out there at Green Gulch, and we've been sort of colleagues bringing these teachings to people. Since that time, I've really enjoyed weaving together what I learned in recovery, which is that I had to take care of the past. I couldn't shut the door on it. And not only that, but my past is a beautiful compost heap of growth that I can offer to another suffering person. You know, I don't need to pretend I wasn't that woman struggling, stumbling along the dark streets of Juneau, Alaska. She's right here with me. And today I feel like I live on two tracks. One track is the track of practice and recovery, of helping other alcoholics and staying sober myself, and taking care of both my practice and my work in recovery. And there's another track running right along next to me, which is my alcoholism. It's always there. And every once in a while, I look over and I say, I see you there. You know, I know you're still with me. I can take care of you and I can take care of myself. So that's what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And one of a very early teaching that I heard in Buddhism was, it was a lecture that was given by Mel Weitzman, and he was sharing about the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which was the last teaching the Buddha gave before he died. And so I write about this teaching in my book, The Zen Way of Recovery. And I want to share with you chapter eight, the eight awarenesses of the awakened being. And I want to thank Ileana for her support tonight. And she has put into the chat a link if you'd like to check out my book, The Zen Way of Recovery. It's published by Shambhala Publications. And they have dubbed it an illuminated path out of the darkness of addiction. So this is chapter eight. The Mahipari Nirvana Sutra was the last teaching the Buddha gave before his death. And Dogen Zenji, our great Soto Zen ancestor, Dogen was the monk that brought Buddhism from China to Japan. In Dogen's masterwork, the Shobo Genzo, he includes this teaching of the Buddha. And this was also the last teaching that Dogen gave before his own death in 2053. And the reason I wanted to share this teaching with you tonight is because it is so applicable to our struggle with addiction, with the insatiability of addiction. And Ileana is going to project onto the screen these eight awarenesses of the awakened person or the awakened being. And these include eight realizations or awakenings that are available to us all. So the eight awarenesses of the awakened being, the first is having few desires. The second is knowing how to be satisfied. The third is enjoying serenity and tranquility. And the fourth is exerting meticulous effort. Five is not forgetting right thought. Six, practicing samadhi, which is a state of concentration or meditation, as we did tonight. Seven, cultivating wisdom. And eight, avoiding idle talk, which, by the way, is one of my favorite kinds of talk. So I have to be really careful about idle talk. So as you know, let's look at these eight awarenesses together. We can easily see that these eight aspects reflect back on one another and fold back and forth with one another. So if we have few desires, then we will know how to be satisfied. And if we know how to be satisfied, then we're free and open to enjoy serenity and tranquility, because we're not always searching outside of ourselves for something to satisfy us. And it's only with serenity and tranquility that we're able to muster our energy and our intention, both our intention to practice the way and our collective intention to stay sober. We can't do that wholeheartedly without serenity and tranquility. Part of exerting meticulous effort is not forgetting right thought, which I feel is just the teachings of recovery and the teachings of the Buddha. In our recovery work, we're encouraged to engage in prayer and meditation, samadhi, and this is tremendous grounding for us as human beings and as people in recovery. And I feel that as we enact, these different awarenesses, we are cultivating wisdom. And as we cultivate wisdom, perhaps we'll find that we're not gossiping quite as often as we used to. Perhaps we'll find that we're being compassionate to other people, that we don't need to air their shortcomings, when they're not around, which I would include that in avoiding idle talk. So let's look a little more closely at these eight awarenesses. If we have few desires, we'll know how to be satisfied. I think another way to think about this is that we can desire and be grateful for what we already have. And in our American culture, our kind of disposable culture, This is such an incredibly deep teaching, to be grateful for what we have. And so the Buddha spoke about this in this sutra. I'm going to quote the Buddha now. This is the Buddha 2,600 years ago talking to his disciples. And again, this is from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. Knowing how much to take of what one already has is called knowing how to be satisfied. You monks should contemplate knowing how to be satisfied if you wish to be liberated from suffering. The Dharma of knowing how to be satisfied are happy and the Dharma of knowing how to be satisfied is the realm of riches, comfort, peace, and tranquility. Those who know how to be satisfied are happy and satisfied even when sleeping on the ground. Those who do not know how to be satisfied are not satisfied, even when dwelling in a heavenly palace like Mar-a-Lago. Those who do not know how to be satisfied are poor, even if they are wealthy, while those who know how to be satisfied are wealthy, even though they have little. Those who do not know how to be satisfied are always tempted by the five desires. And those who know how to be satisfied are consoled by those who know how to be satisfied. This is called knowing how to be satisfied. Now, there are a lot of lists in Buddhism. The five desires are wealth, sex, fame, food, and sleep. Well, right away we have a problem because included in these five desires are things that we need to do in order to stay alive and to keep the species going. Sex is a natural human drive and a wonderful part of our human life. Without food or sleep, we can't live. Fame and wealth are perhaps extremes, but even the Buddha is famous, and some with wealth have done great things for other people. So I would say that since the Buddha taught the value of living moderately, we can see that our lives and our personalities can be impacted and distorted if we go to extremes in any of these five desires. Again, those five desires are wealth, sex, fame, food, and sleep. This teaching goes right to the heart of our everyday suffering. The suffering of always wanting things to be just a little bit different than the way that they are. We tend to think that we could be truly happy, truly satisfied, if only we could make just a few little adjustments. If we lived somewhere else or had a different job, if we were single or if we were married. Someone asked the millionaire John D. Rockefeller, how much money is enough? And his answer was just a little bit more. Being able to be satisfied with what we already have, being able to have few desires, depends on whether we take our lives for granted, whether we take our gifts for granted, whether we can be grateful and appreciative of our lives just as they are. And of course, in our recovery literature, it says that acceptance is the root of our, can be the root of our satisfaction, just to be able to accept life on life's terms. Some of you may know Edward S.B. Brown, a wonderful teacher in my life and a Zen priest. Ed wrote the Tassajara Bread Book, and that book was translated into many languages and brought a lot of people to Zen Center, especially in the early days. And Ed was my practice instructor when I first came to Zen Center. And he said to me once, if you aren't happy with what you have, what makes you think you'd be happy with more? If you aren't happy with what you have, what makes you think you'd be happy with more? I think that's a lovely koan, really. And you know, Ed was really instrumental in my stopping drinking. He said to me once, I mean, it took me a while to stop, but when I first came to Zen Center, you know, it was clear that I was very mixed up. And I would come to Zazen in paint-spattered overalls, and I'd only come to Zazen in the evening. And he stopped me in the hallway one day and he said, "You know, do you ever come to morning Zazen?" I said, "Well, no, it's a little early for me." He said, "The thing about morning Zazen is it changes what you do the night before." So I think I wasn't fooling anybody in my early days there. If there's a silver lining to going through a difficult time, I think it's that when we go through hardship, we may have the ability to find joy in seemingly small things. You know, it says in the big book that we're like survivors of the crash of an ocean liner. And we're so elated to look around and see other people who are recovering with us. Just the sight of a delicate tree decorated with cherry blossoms can make us happy. Just a glass of cool water, a breath of fresh air, or the smile of a stranger can console us. We're grateful for simple things. We talk about the pink cloud of recovery, and for me, I think that pink cloud was the elation and clarity that came to me in early sobriety when I realized that I didn't need alcohol to enhance my everyday life, and that I suddenly had true friends and could be a true friend on the path, friends who could encourage and support me in my sobriety, and that I could do the same for them. This, to me, is the heart of recovery. If we do the work of recovery, this joy and satisfaction will only increase. When someone you love is dying, and you know, I think I thought when I got sober, bad things would never happen anymore. But what did happen was I was able to go through difficult things with much more clarity and intention. And one of those things was being with my father through the process of dying. And I was sober, and there was no way I could have gone through that experience, and experienced my father in his wholeness the way I could, sober. And my brother's also in recovery, and we were able to do that with one another. When someone you love is dying, all the things about them that you took for granted or that might have annoyed you suddenly seem so precious and dear. But those precious things are always close at hand if we can be open to them. If we can turn towards our own actual lives and appreciate what is right in front of us. There's a saying in Zen, painted cakes don't satisfy. If we have some idea in our mind about what would finally satisfy us, if we crave some ideal that is always just out of reach, we can't enjoy the actual cake that is right in front of us. The Buddha told us that our suffering begins with tanha, which literally means thirst. So appropriate for those of us who struggle with alcohol. There's no better example of this than the insatiability of addiction. So isn't that interesting that Buddha called craving thirst in Sanskrit? The Buddhist wheel of life pictures different realms. Hungry ghosts are they're called pretta. Hungry ghosts are pictured as beings with huge empty stomachs, but pinhole mouths, and with necks so thin that they cannot swallow. A hungry ghost is one who's always looking outside of herself for the new thing that will satisfy the craving within. Hungry ghosts are characterized by insatiable hunger and craving, with addiction, obsession, and compulsion. In the world of addiction, we constantly seek outside of ourselves for the cure for our insatiable yearning for relief. We're never truly satisfied by our addictions because though they offer an illusory temporary relief, they don't give us what we really long for: communion, peace, a sense of being at home in the world, a sense of being at ease in our own bodies. In fact, the longer we live in the realm of addiction, these comforts gradually recede into the distance, and we are bereft, sick, and alone. When we sit in silence and stillness on the cushion or in a chair, we are seeing what it might be like to have few desires. We're learning how to be satisfied. We are enjoying serenity and tranquility. It requires meticulous effort to stay in our meditation posture and to cultivate right thought that's based on Buddha's teachings. This continuous practice, day after day, year after year, leads us to samadhi, to the arising of wisdom. And naturally, when we are sitting in silence, we are avoiding idle talk. The eight awarenesses of the awakened being are all available to us in our sitting practice and in our work of recovery. We are practicing restraint rather than giving into our habitual tendency to run off here and there, seeking constant stimulation. And of course, one of the fourth Buddhist precept is not to intoxicate the mind or body of self or others. You know, if we look at the precepts, not to steal, not to lie, not to intoxicate, not to misuse sexuality, the 10 prohibitory precepts really are the opposite of addiction. I think if we just wholeheartedly practice those precepts, we would be pretty, have a lot of integrity in our own recovery. And I also want to say that when I came to Zen practice and stopped drinking, I used meditation and my black robe, you know, as a way to try to be somebody else, as a way to set aside that person that I had been. And then I learned that Dogen said, this very mind is Buddha. And it took me 5 years to realize, oh, this mind is Buddha, not some other mind that's waiting for me further down the trail. You know, we may have come to practice in recovery after experiencing terrible suffering, after a long season in hell. We all have a long season in hell, even those who aren't in recovery, of course. But in practice and recovery, we find the resources to cultivate satisfaction and contentment and to find a new freedom and a new happiness. Ileana mentioned that I taught kids for 35 years. I've retired from teaching, and I really miss the shining faces of my third graders who tumbled up to my door each morning like luminous beings. I got to see them today because I went out to the school where I used to teach, and my last class of third graders are now seventh graders, and it was so terrific to see them again and to see who they are becoming. Once, when I was dealing with a very difficult situation in my life, I arrived at school to see one of my former students, Helena, waiting for me at the door with a wrapped present. She was in eighth grade by this time. I smiled and said, for me? And she replied, open it, open it. It was a book called F in Exams, The Very Best Totally Wrong Answers by Richard Benson, a collection of student responses on various school tests. Question, what was Sir Isaac Newton famous for? Answer, he invented gravity. Question, is the sun or the moon more important? Answer, the moon gives us light at night when we need it, and the sun gives us light during the day when we don't need it. Therefore, the moon is more important. Makes sense to me. There was no way that Helena could have known that I needed cheering up on that day, and that her generous act of kindness would be something I would never forget. And that she would remind me how important it is to pass kindness along to others without knowing how it will land, where it will grow, and who it might affect. And, you know, I can just picture Helena as a third grader. In that moment that I shared with Helena when I opened up that book, I was flooded with some of the elements that we that can contribute to our peace and happiness, our serenity and tranquility, connection with other human beings. I felt appreciated and recognized by this lovely former student, the healing qualities of laughter and humor, knowing to the core of my being that teaching children is meaningful work. And beyond that, I knew that it made Helena happy to find this perfect present for me and to give it to me, knowing that I would get a kick out of it. She was also saying to me, I know you. I remember you. What an incredible gift I got that day. In our recovery work, we can also enact the elements of happiness or satisfaction and wisdom. And, you know, I teach classes at Zen Center on happiness and a class based on Rick Hansen's wonderful book, Buddha's Brain. And studies on happiness and studies on brain health come together to suggest that these things, which we do in recovery, also lead to happiness and to a healthy brain. And they were just intuitively embedded in the recovery work that we do. So these are building a strong network of relationships. That's number one in happiness and brain health research. Your health is at risk if you are lonely and isolated. And so when we walk in the rooms of recovery, we have a sangha. When we come to a Buddhist practice place, we have a sangha, a strong network of relationships. In Buddhism, we take responsibility for our actions. We know that what we do in the world counts. And in recovery, we not only take responsibility for our actions, but we have a very practical guide for clearing up the past and making amends. Our practice in recovery teaches how to stay with difficult situations and emotions. And you know, I think the reason for that is we can pause before we act out in a situation. We can feel our emotions deeply, knowing that we can decide whether it's something that we need to express or something we need to process ourselves. And often we find that this is something I need to share with another person, but I'm not able to do it right now because I'm so upset. So learning how to stay with difficult situations and emotions, this comes with the sacred pause that we're given in practice and recovery to pause and take a deep breath before we speak or act. The Bodhisattva path is helping other beings. And this is deeply embedded in our recovery. We find that we can help others. This is something I learned in recovery, not Buddhism, but learning how to avoid being too angry, too hungry, too angry, too lonely, or too tired. That's that watchword, halt. That's been really valuable for me. Cultivating and expressing gratitude. This is one of the hallmarks of happiness and also brain health. And this is what the Buddha was saying, you know, to be grateful and happy for what we have. Recovery and practice both make us feel that our lives matter, that we have something to offer other beings. And also being able to enjoy the simple pleasures of everyday life. You know, addiction is such a jagged curve, the ups and the downs. And I think in a way we were a little bit attached to the drama of all that, right? Pretty romantic and dramatic. And now we're living on a more even keel. And it's so wonderful to, you know, this may sound crazy, but I paid a parking ticket the other day. It gave me so much pleasure because, you know, I used to just put those in my glove compartment and they would come back later to haunt me. So this is a gift of recovery and practice to take care of the next right thing, you know. Thank you for that, Ileana. These things can give us real satisfaction rather than the painted cakes, the simulated and artificial satisfaction of substance abuse or behavioral addictions. So, you know, you may be here because of sex and love addiction or gambling addiction. Maybe you're a grateful member of Al-Anon. I hope you can identify with these teachings too. Stepping away from the big highs and lows of addiction, the drama and the confusion, we turn towards our own lives. We can meditate with others and practice being satisfied with this present moment. I came to Buddhism torn up with bitterness and resentment. I didn't even know that at the time. And if we're torn up with bitterness and resentment, if we're caught in our anger and rage, we're much more likely to cause suffering to ourselves and others. Our practice and recovery offer us this sacred pause, the ability to wait and breathe, and then to act with wisdom, serenity, and courage. So in my book, The Zen Way of Recovery, in each chapter, I offer some practices and reflections that you can do to deepen this teaching, because I think it's not enough to read about it or even talk about it. We have to do something. And so I'd like to ask Ileana to put these on the screen so we could talk about them a little bit. Let's just begin by sitting quietly, and I sit Zazen, which is just being in touch with my breath. But whatever your meditation practice is, let's just do that for a few moments. I'd like to ask you to bring to mind the things that make you feel peaceful and joyful. Often these are things we find in nature or in communion with other people. And I'd like to invite you to vow to conscientiously practice those things in your everyday life. You might even make a list of them, you know, to make sure you're coming back, circling back to those things that you know make you feel peaceful and joyful. And by the same token, we can consider the habits that pull us away from joy and satisfaction. You know, what kind of things interrupt your joy and peacefulness? Too much screen time? Obsessive worry? Chronic busyness at the expense of your inner life? Maybe you need to let go of some relationships that are toxic or too consuming. So on the one hand, to recognize what brings us peace and joy, and also to keep in mind those things that interrupt and take away from our peacefulness. And recognize that, hey, we can actually do something about that. We're not just victims of that, of those distractions. I'd like you now to bring to mind someone who has been especially helpful to you. A grandmother, a sponsor, a teacher, a friend. And hold their face in your mind with joy and love. Make a vow to call that person, to write to them, to tell them how much they've meant to you. I recently wrote a letter to Helena to remind her of her present and to thank her again for her gift. As soon as you can, maybe tomorrow, take a walk, preferably in nature, but you can do this in the city for sure. As you walk, open your eyes your ears, all your senses, and let yourself be bathed in the ever available and consoling present moment. Ileana, if you could advance that a bit. Feel your feet on the ground, feel the air on your face, and allow yourself to be grateful for this life. The eight awarenesses of the awakened being. Thank you so much for your kind attention. And now it's your turn. I hope that something I've said has triggered or reminded you of your practice in recovery. Oh, there's my book. Kevin wrote a really nice blurb for my book, so that was really great. I'm a little sheepish about that illuminated path out of the darkness of addiction. Oh, well. So please make use of the raise hand function. It should be at the bottom of your screen. That'll bump you up to the top. And I'm going to ask Ileana to call on people.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.